Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for episode 82 of the podcast. Today I'll be talking with Sarah Huffman, Assistant Director of the Center for Communication Excellence, Elena Kotos, Director of the Center for Communication Excellence and Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics in the English Department, and Kimberly Becker, Lecturer in English, all three guests at Iowa State University. Their book, Preparing to Publish, was published open access by Iowa State University Digital Press this year. Whether you're new to academic publishing or have been at this work for the better part of a career, the question why is certainly one you've entertained, probably often. Why do academics write articles in just this way? Why don't academics write their research into a text type that isn't an article? There'll be a better way, won't there? This article format seems so conventional, so clunky, so unfit to purpose, especially when you just want to come out and say it. We found this. It's new. No one knows about it yet. Pay attention. Why is that not possible? Well, dear imaginary person asking questions that I've put into your mouth, to be sure it is possible just to come out and say what you think in a research article. We academics would be poorly served if that wasn't possible. I mean, our trade is thinking. And if one primary outlet for academic research actually hindered us in doing the labor of thinking, well then, it would be a very bad outlet indeed. Nonetheless, very many students, still a large number of early career researchers, and definitely more career academics than anyone would care to admit, cannot really recognize the purposiveness of the research article. And that is truly a terrible thing, because it means that all these bright and hard-working people are unable to use the research article to their own ends, are unable to see the opportunities for communication and persuasion in this paradigmatic form of the research project. Too many of us in academia, and also in industry, just do not get how to put our research purposes into this research document. Because no, the research article is not as intuitive as, say, a mattress or an iPhone, but still it is a very manageable device for the conveyance of information and the transference of ideas, when someone's shown you how. And that is precisely what Sarah Huffman, Elena Kotos, and Kimberly Becker do in their e-book, Preparing to Publish. This book is a teacher without the teacher. That's how clear and direct the authors have made the descriptions, explanations, and illustrations of the research article. The authors make explicit the goal of almost every sentence of the research article, so that academic writers can know where to come out saying whatever they can want to say about their research. And the techniques for saying things are made explicit, so that academic writers can know, too, how to be saying whatever they can have to say about their research. This book teaches, but it can also be taught. Because preparing to publish is a valuable pedagogical resource for anyone teaching EAP to graduate students or postdocs of any discipline at all. Preparing to publish does just what it says on the label. And many a struggling academic writer will have today's guests to thank when the next paper comes out and says it just the way that the writer had intended. So let's begin today's episode. Sarah Huffman, Elena Kotas, Kimberly Becker, and Preparing to Publish. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Scholarly Communication.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Hi, thank you.
Your book, as I make clear in the introduction, and as is clear in any book because it's on the cover, is titled Preparing to Publish. And when I consider your target audience, primarily graduates who are submitting their first articles, maybe even their very first article for publication, then I see how you have stepped in to offer help in a very crucial transition period for every academic, right? That move from the school to the world of research. And I often tell my own graduates who I help writing here in Germany that, and these people come from natural sciences, also computer science, that when you're making that move, you're moving from the world of teaching and explaining to searching and claiming. I wonder if that those labels can make any sense to you, if you see your book helping in that sort of a transition.
Well, I guess I can say a few words here. I really like the way you put it in terms of claiming. The way the book is written is really helping students understand that the research article discourse is very much about making claims, and not only making claims, but making sure that those claims are substantiated with evidence from previous research, as well as with evidence from the research that's reported.
And is there anything, Sarah or Kimberly, you would like to add to this idea of moving from the classroom into the world of actual research and understanding how to do that?
No, I think that, Elena's pretty much covered it. The idea is the book is, for graduate students or novice research writers. It doesn't necessarily need to be only for graduate students. We have a lot of postdocs that we serve as well at Iowa State. And I think that postdoc community, or even, new researcher, new academic professor, any kind of a role where someone would need to be, disseminating their research to this this academic audience, I think that would, be the ultimate goal of the book. I think anybody in that realm could get a lot from it.
I think one of the first things that caught my attention was after two or three pages of how to use the book, instructions basically for either a student, someone who is the target audience, or also an instructor who may want to be teaching this material. The first content that we get is the word argument. And this really jumped out at me because it made clear this idea that we're, for very many, I would say, graduate students or early career researchers, that this isn't necessarily front in their minds. I'm quoting from the book here about arguments, about the fact that the entire article, each individual sentence is laden with argument. And it is for this reason, I carry on quoting, that it is important that the research writers are intentional about what argument they want to make. These are some of the very basic issues that in my experience, and perhaps you can also supplement that with your own experience there, that these sorts of writers definitely are struggling with, that they don't see happening in the research that they're reading.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I think, it's true that Elena picked up on your use of the word claims, and I think that is a really important way to contextualize the way we present the information in the book. Because in my experience, graduate students especially, but certainly any novice researcher, their real struggle is figuring out how to take a stance and position themselves as a disciplinary insider. They've been trying to establish themselves, and so crossing that bridge into the world of the expert and conveying that in their writing is really the big hurdle that they have to kind of jump over.
And I will follow up to say here that, again, going back to the book, the way we have the material presented is to help these novice writers understand how to accomplish certain goals of the discourse. So they need to understand that their audience has certain expectations, because the research article is a genre that, like you said at the beginning in your introduction, is highly conventionalized. So number one, they need to understand that there are certain expectations of, you know, on the use of those conventions. And then another thing is for them to understand that there, you should be doing things with language in order to be able to build that argument and articulate your claims clearly and effectively. So thinking about, okay, with every single sentence, what am I doing? What is the purpose of me saying this or that? And if I'm saying this or that, does it make sense to me only, or am I using language that's appropriately conveying my argumentative message that I'm putting in a paragraph or even at the level of a sentence? So that's why the book presents these communicative goals, which we linguists call moves, as well as the rhetorical strategies that are used to accomplish those goals that we call steps. And we stick to this terminology because throughout our experience of teaching the research article genre and using this, I may call it linguistic jargon, it still makes a lot of sense when we explain it to students. So,
absolutely. These are patterns, whether they have, you know, intentionally tried to notice these patterns that are occurring in published writing in their field. These are patterns that they very easily pick up on. So in research writing instruction that we do, it's clear that, you know, they have been typically reading, you know, when they're looking a little bit deeper into published writing in their respective disciplines. You know, they're commonly just looking for content. What are the ideas? What did this person do in their methods, or what did they find? But in this type of a book, the idea was that, you know, we're helping them really break down what their research story is and determining how they're going to tell that story through this lens of a scientific argument, building up their scientific argument. That's pretty much one of the reasons why we started the book off, even before How to Use This Book. Chapter one provides this base of what we see as a scientific argument and how we can start formulating that through an empirical research article.
All three of you bring up really interesting points, which it is nice to put labels next to. And that's exactly, Elena, as you say, the book does. It gives us, you know, communicative goals. It gives us rhetorical strategies and so on, so that we understand what's going on. What you, Sarah, were just saying, I think, is really the struggle that very many, you know, graduate student writers who are becoming graduate research writers, they're in, as I was calling it, this transition period from, you know, a school environment to a research environment. I mean, they're focused very much on what you, Sarah, were just talking about, the subject matter. What is it that they're talking about? And that's, mm-hmm. you know, understandable. I mean, very much of it is new and complex to them. But the book adds, and what you've just said, all three of you, adds on these two other layers, which I think, and I would like to get to some of the visuals in the book, because that, they really, I think, will help students understand what's going on in these different layers. But the communicative goals, in other words, I've got an audience, a set of people, there's something interpersonal going on here. And that, of in my experience, is clearly not the first thought that comes to any, you know, academic's mind or particularly a graduate student's mind, right? They're still focusing on that what, the subject matter. And then on top of that, just as Kimberly, you were saying, this bridge that you create, you know, this rhetorical strategy, how do I put that into the text? That you're always thinking about, what is that next thing that I'm going to say and why? How is it going to help me achieve my goal? All of these different levels, I think, make through the book it very clear as to what it is that needs to go on if you want to be successful at this. One of the examples that you give, which works with the idea of a bridge that I might give our listeners also a concrete example to work with, is from the title into the paper, probably into the introduction section, you need to bridge that with the abstract, you tell us. And perhaps the abstract is a nice place to begin to talk about some of the advice that's given in the book. Would anyone care to expand on that idea of bridging through abstracts or other important areas in the abstract where these communicative goals and these strategies show up?
Well, you are perfectly right in that there is that connection between what the abstract presents and what the entire paper presents. And so the abstract is obviously a snapshot of the content of the scientific contribution of the research that's reported, but it is also a very succinct way of presenting the scientific argument. Typically when we teach abstract writing at the very end, after we teach how to write introduction, methods, results, discussion, and conclusions. So, you know, in the introduction, you would start your argument by highlighting a certain problem and proposing a solution. And then in the method section, you would be very descriptive about the methodology. So the abstract needs to reflect both the research goals and how those goals were accomplished methodologically or approached methodologically. And then what's the purpose of the results section, that's really contributing to science, bringing new empirical evidence into the research field. And so the section itself spends a lot of time on that, while the abstract just highlights the take-home messages in this very short research story presented in the abstract. And then the abstract would typically wrap up with what is the value of research and the real contribution, which is something that pertains to the goals of the discussion conclusion section. So there is a reason why we teach the abstract last, because we believe that students would need to know the complexity and the different goals and strategies of the section. And then they would make a decision for what are more appropriate to be used in the abstract. We have them look at different types of abstracts, but part of the teaching process is directing them to texts in their own discipline. And like Sarah mentioned, identifying patterns there. And we want them to determine the type of abstract that is more common in their field, more common in the type of journal that they're submitting to, and then make decisions about how to shape and structure the short version of their research story in the introduction by using the rhetorical strategies that are more appropriate to be used in the introduction. So that's how I would answer this question.
And also I would just add that from a practicality standpoint, we try to help students understand that that abstract is, you know, that can really be the make it or break it for the entire research article. That could be the point of decision whether a researcher, a reader is going to download or potentially buy the research article, or that's maybe even an evaluative measure for if you're submitting a conference abstract, for example. It might be on your abstract, you know, that you are evaluated as to whether you'll get into the conference or be accepted into this conference. So it's one of the reasons we talk about the form features and obviously length and word choice and grammar and even the nitty gritty of these abstracts, because they, and you know, practicality wise, they're integral to an academic success.
Yeah, I have to jump in right there about what you're talking about, Sarah, because the abstract, I mean, Elena, you're very right. I mean, the abstract is not the place to start teaching how to write a research article because it is so complex. But that's just what's so interesting about it. It's and I'd be very happy to hear all your views on this. It's almost gotten to the point, like, what is the abstract and what is it meant to do? There is so much being asked of it. I think you even make a joke along these lines in the book somewhere as to that's a lot to ask of, you know, 200 words. You give various definitions, a high stakes document or make it or break it, as Sarah is talking about right now. I've heard it described as a sort of advertisement. Stephen Hurd, who's written a guide for science writers, in the book, you talk about it being an abbreviated representation of the paper itself. Informative but indicative is also an interesting way of looking at it, in the idea basically that it points to a lot but includes very little of the content. I guess the trouble I'm trying to stir up right now is, what do we say about the abstract?
Yeah, this is a hard one, because as you've pointed out, there's a lot of kind of contrasting ways to describe an abstract. I was just going back and sort of looking at some of the ways we described it in the book. And, you know, the descriptors include accurate, concise, non-evaluative, coherent, readable. You know, that's a lot to ask. And then there are all these different types of abstracts, and there are disciplinary differences. So I think the challenge in that section of the book was trying to address the really vast amount of differences that occur within an abstract, just, you know, whether it's in a journal article or for a conference proceeding, or yeah, there's just a lot of differences that go on. And then besides that, it's just an inherently kind of non-intuitive writing style. Cause like Elena said, you know, you sort of do it at the end of the research and the writing, because you need to have everything wrapped up before you can summarize it. I mean, you can't start summarizing without some original thing to summarize. So yeah, abstracts are really, really difficult.
And part of the difficulty for novice research writers is, and not only, but is deciding what is really going to make it or break it. And here it comes to the content that they select. Okay. Typically what they would write in their introduction and literature review when highlighting a gap or a problem, it's not just one thing, right? There is multiple factors that play into the motivation to conduct research and justify and rationalize the need to do the research. So what, you know, is there one big gap? Or how do you actually present this in the abstract in a very concise way, but still how do you make it very convincing to convince your readers that the paper is worth reading their time or examining or evaluating, depending on where the abstract is going. And then when it comes to talking about the methodologies, that's very complex again. So what do you just say that it's a mixed method study, or do you feature some innovative aspect of your methodology only, or and then with the results, how do you put so much into just a few words, a sentence or two, depending on what length is accepted by the targeted venue. So what's really the take home message that you want the readers to take out of it? And it's also difficult for students at times to see that what's the actual value of their study. So, you know, they tend to be focused on, I did this, this, I'm excited about what I found, but I'm not quite sure how that fits in the big world of science in my field. I'm so little, I'm humble. How do I make claims about the value of this work, right? So that's another struggle that they may have internally before they actually put this into words. And in terms of the importance of the abstract, once you get a hold of how to produce those abstracts, how to not only write them in an efficient, you know, rhetorically effective way, but also content selective type of way, it's helpful to have you know, different opportunities for practicing, perhaps writing the same abstract for different purposes. So one would be submission to a conference. One would be the abstract to a paper you're submitting for publication. Another potentially could be an exercise to write the same abstract for a grant proposal. And so that should help students consider the audiences and the purpose of the abstract from different kinds of angles and different audiences and how their argument should be shaped in view of who they're structuring it for.
You used two phrases there, Elena, that I think will be very helpful to novice research writers. You talk about this content that is selected, and then you talk about the actual value of the research. And that idea of selecting and value, I think, is really key here. Later in the book, when you're talking about abstracts, you give a number of WH questions that can guide you. And the first two are really indicative of just what you're saying, I believe. This who is the audience and why was the research undertaken? What was your motivation and who's going to care? In other words, that you went through the trouble. I suppose the idea I'm floating out there for you to think to respond to is, it seems like one of the things that helps rhetorically writing is when graduate students also start to pay attention not only to the subject matter, but who's doing what with that subject matter. In other words, multitasking in their reading of the research and understanding, so what are the motivations behind studies X, Y, Z, and so on and so forth, and how can I fit my motivation into that pattern?
Is this a question for me?
It's just out there for anyone to take, or no one.
Yeah, I don't want to be dominated in the discussion, so maybe Sarah or Kimberly have to say something, and if anything, I can follow up.
Sure, I did just want to say that, I always in my research writing classes kind of akin this to, you know, we want to make sure that the students are focusing on the context in which they are communicating. So they are communicators and they have readers and audience members. This looks different in research writing realms versus science communication realms. And being aware that there is that, you know, they are not writing in a vacuum. They are writing to someone and they need to have that purpose and that the audience's expectations as well as the audience's current understanding of the topic area in mind, that's of critical importance. But also knowing that they are standing on the foundation of others who have gone before them in this discipline, doing similar types of work. Of course, they're contributing new scientific knowledge, and they need to make sure that they're highlighting that and explicating the value of that. However, they are not, you know, reinventing the wheel. They need to make sure that the foundation that they lay out in the introduction, and then again, weave back in through different parts of the research article, shows that they recognize that that communication, that conversation that's happening with other members of their discipline, and that they're building from that discipline. And this is how they are contributing to that through their findings, through their unique research.
And
Elena.
I just wanted to take this a little bit outside of the abstract because your questions are really, the last question that you asked is true for the abstract, but it is true for every single component of the research article. Who is your audience? So when you are shaping your argument for the need to conduct research, then who are you talking to? Okay, who would value and really understand that need and appreciate your attempt to address a particular gap, right? So you need to be aware who you're writing to when you start shaping your argument. When you present your methods, for example, again, who's your audience? How much do they know about the methodologies that you've employed? because this will dictate, perhaps if you come up with something innovative, you need to make a stronger type of claim, indicating that this is a credible, reliable type of methodological approach, even if it's innovative, right? And then when you describe it, again, it depends on how much you expect the audience to know. That would dictate the level of detail that you would put into one or another component when describing it. Again, when you talk about, let's say, discussing the results, think about your audience. What would appeal to that particular audience? Why, you know, even in interpreting the results and trying to explain, it's again, who it will be reading it, what are they looking for, and why they really would understand and agree with the motivation and justification for the study once they see the results and how you describe them, how you explain them, and what implications you talk about that may be pertinent to your audience.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
To be able to answer these questions, who and why, in other words, who's going to be your audience and how are they going to understand you and why are they going to care about something like this? Why would you do a study of this sort? So again, we're back to audience. Who's going to understand that a study like this needs to be done? All these questions rely on exactly what the book encourages readers to do. Go out there and see how that's being done. Notice that other level or levels, that fine film that's over the top of every research article, where you might, as a graduate student, only be seeing content matter, is actually colored rhetorically. Yeah. And once you start to notice that film or that layer, you can never really look away anymore from it. The book makes it clear that that's something that you need to be going out into your own field and doing on your own. And it gives fine advice and very hands-on advice on how to do that, showing really on a sentence-by-sentence level, just, Elena, as you've been describing, right? And here's an example from a methods section. This is why it would probably have been put together this way. Here's an example from a results section, and so on and so forth. I mean, identifying these patterns. My question it would be here, okay, how much will either a graduate student or an early career researcher or any researcher be serving their own purposes to be going out and doing that on their own, which is essentially what they'd be doing anyway, right? Because they'd be reading the research anyway and they can just notice more. And how much of it could also be served well by working together with a corpus? I know this is something that all of you are familiar with. I know that, for instance, the Center for Communication Excellence, which has been on our show, uses corpus methods. I suppose I'm interested in the affordances of the two approaches for the researchers themselves.
Well, I know that both Elena and Kimberly will have a lot to say about this, because we're all very much advocates of the corpus approach to instruction and the learning of academic genres as a whole. But yeah, I will say that, you know, through this class, you know, I often talk to my students about, and I say this at the very beginning of the course, that you will never look at your writing in your field the same way again. The goal is for them to go forward as analyzers of writing, as analyzers of communication in general, and be a lot more intentional about determining the function of what that writer, what that author is doing, and how they are effectively or maybe ineffectively achieving those goals. And so it's a little bit of a joke in my classes that, you know, you've ruined my ability to go in and just mine some research articles for the information that I was seeking. I just usually went in and looked at the method section or just was looking for the results. But now I can't help but see these goals and strategies or these moves and steps in action and what these authors are doing, because it's the class and through this book, the idea is to turn readers, novice research writers, in this case, into, you know, more critical viewers of and analyzers of text in their disciplines.
I'll jump in and just say a little bit about my experience is that students tend to think that academic writing is this objective kind of faceless entity, but in fact, it's very much negotiating lots of different social relationships, and it's pulling together, you know, this whole rhetorical situation of the author and the audience and the purpose. And I think students get so bogged down in the complexity of the content because, I mean, we're talking about, you know, very, very high level content. That they forget there is that the reader has needs, and that the reader doesn't necessarily see their motivation. You're fascinated. Of course, you're fascinated by this topic. You went to graduate school in this subject, but that doesn't mean that, you know, your motivations are clear to your reader. And so, you know, creating this understanding how, you know, the writing needs to acknowledge and construct and negotiate all of these relationships between writer and reader to explicitly indicate evaluations of the material and acknowledge alternative views and, you know, bring in all these different voices, and ultimately, you know, arguing for the research questions. When I was a graduate student and someone said to me, you know, your literature review is just an argument for your research questions, that blew me away. That really, because I saw it as just a sort of objective dumping ground for, this is what we did. Here's the science, here's the methodology. And in fact, it's not at all that way.
Elena, before you come in, because I mean, this question is going to be one I'm sure that you eat up. I really just have to emphasize there, Kimberly, what you've been saying. I think that's just fantastic, this idea that you have to see that readers have needs. I mean, just the way that you put that, I think really will shake up some people's view of what they're doing, that your topic or your motivations as a researcher are not givens, you know? Really, really well put.
Yes, thank you, Kimberly. We tend to forget how we felt when we were students learning the genre. And we tend to focus on how do we, you know, do a good job teaching. So, and I would want to say a few more words to follow up perhaps on what Sarah said about how reading, you know, reading of published research articles for students is not the same anymore. Because what they start doing is not only reading to learn, but reading to analyze how that written material has been produced in such a clear, effective way. So basically what we're trying to do with the book is to give students a toolkit, right? You can think of it as a toolkit, like here are the goals and here are the rhetorical strategies that you can use to both analyze and see how that's happening in effective discourse that's been published and how you can shape your own. And in the book, we also provide examples, like you mentioned, Daniel, and these examples come from a large multidisciplinary corpus that we built, I can say maybe about 10 years ago, and we've added more disciplines to it. So In our prior research, we developed this, what is now the core of the book, this framework of these moves and steps of these rhetorical goals and strategies that apply across disciplines. And that's probably one of the highest value of the book, because then, you know, we're not being prescriptive saying that you should do everything, but we're saying this is your toolkit. You can look at your corpus, collect your own short, compile a short collection of articles, and see what applies, see what your discipline does. So with that, we give students a certain level of autonomy to shape their learning and to decide what applies to them. And when exploring their own corpus, or here at Iowa State, we have the research writing tutor, where we have, you mentioned, Danielle, the colors. We have a color annotated, color-coded corpus that shows the users, the students, what, like, at the level of a sentence, right? Every single sentence, what is it doing rhetorically and in terms of what communicative goal it's trying to accomplish? So I just wanted to mention that as a follow-up, so you can go on with your questions now, if you have any others.
Yeah, sure. No, I suppose I'd like to extend the question I had asked earlier about, okay, so the early career researchers, the novice writers of research, they can very valuably extend their own study of the rhetoric of their field by using a corpus. I'd like to extend that to us EAP instructors or people ourselves and ask, okay, well, with the help of a corpus or with one's own reading of the actual, you know, literature in, say, biology or machine learning or chemistry or whatever the field might be, is it possible for us to also then become really disciplinary inside type instructors helping people who are perhaps even beyond the graduate level, so the postdoc level or even faculty? My question, to bring it to a point, is where are the limits for the EAP specialist who has command of a corpus and who is also trained in the area of communicative goals and rhetorical strategies? Because I guess the way I see it is that those are the three things that go into making a great research article: the subject knowledge, the communicative goals, and the research strategies. And if you think, well, gee, you know, an EAP specialist has two of those and can learn a little bit about the first, and wouldn't they be a great, you know, co-pilot, let's say, for postdocs or even staff who are looking to increase their publishing or improve the quality of their publishing?
Well, that's a great question. And I think Kimberly should address this one because she's worked extensively with postdocs.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, when I when I am at first trying to convince someone that it's worthwhile to work with an EAP specialist, such as a consultant, a writing consultant, you know, I usually say, you're the disciplinary expert, and I'm the linguist. And so, you know, the line gets drawn, as you said in your question, where does the line get drawn at the level of content? You know, I cannot speak to that disciplinary content. I don't have knowledge in your field, but I can help you find linguistic resources that are the tools you need to build those arguments and make those, you know, accomplish those communicative goals. So I always pitch it as this, you know, kind of this toolkit metaphor, this metaphor of like a toolkit and just expanding the resources you have in hand to further your writing, because they know the science, of course, they're experts in their field. But where they often struggle is, you know, how to say what they want to say. They know exactly what they want to say. They don't know how to say it. And of course, it's not as easy as just saying, how do you say it? As I talked about before, there's this issue of readers' needs and rhetorical situation. But once I can show them, and I think this book is a wonderful tool, because, you know, it's hard to have a linguist on hand, an EAP expert on hand at any time. It's not convenient, but this book is very convenient. And I think that's, you know, why it's such a great resource, being open access, that anytime you're writing, you can open it up and you can look at the section. You know, I'm struggling to write implications, and you can find that in the book, and you can see what, you know, exact resources other writers have used, exact phrasing that you can repurpose and adapt to fit your own goals. And so that's kind of how I see my role.
And speaking about EAP specialists and specialists or faculty in the disciplines or postdocs in the disciplines, maybe I can share a little story that I've recently experienced. So when this book, yes, we want to have it being used in our EAP classes, right? But it's certainly open access, and we are more than happy when faculty in the disciplines reach out, and this is the story that I'm about to share. One faculty member, he's very advanced. He's a professor already in industrial manufacturing systems engineering. And when he saw the book, he emailed saying, you know what? You know how long I've been waiting for something like this? It puts what I don't know how to say into words. And I know how to talk to my students because of this book. And so that is a very nice story to share. I think it's kind of a highlight, because we know in EAP, and it's very difficult to have this, we don't live in the ideal world where we would have this solid and systematic partnership between EAP specialists and disciplinary specialists. So if we as EAP specialists can supply something to the disciplinary specialist, we can supply materials like some that we've included in this book, we're doing them a great favor. And there was another thought that I had. I don't know if I lost it.
Maybe it'll occur to you, but I would like to follow up with what you're saying right there. If I had known that story, I would have opened the entire interview with it, because that encapsulates for me also the book. I mean, it's very clear that anyone could just walk into this book and really start to get things out of it. It's been my experience, and that's what the book seems to illustrate for me as well, that if you are speaking to people who are advanced in their careers from graduate level up, it's almost as if when you talk about the rhetoric, you're activating things in their minds that are just slumbering. Just as you've said with this staff member this professor who says, I wanted to be able to say these things. I want to say things. I just didn't know how. And now I know how. So for instance, just the idea that you make it clear to them that when they're writing a research article, they're reaching out and showing, hey, I've got something here that I think you're going to care about. And I think you can use it in your own research, right? When you start saying that to postdocs and so on, it sort of immediately makes sense, even if they hadn't thought about it in that terms. But that's the beauty of the book. It gives you those terms. That's what most of these people are missing.
Right. It's equipping them with the vocabulary that maybe they intuitively have been, they've gained this understanding maybe on their own or through years of experience, but they can't necessarily translate that to the students. And they want their students so badly to be able to effectively write and convey their research. But you had a question about limits and where you see the limits for a book like this, or maybe postdocs or even faculty using this book. I really feel like we're all in the position where we could all be better writers. We could all keep refining our understanding of what's going on in the genre and our response to that. Plus, you know, as we all know, the genre is emerging. We have such things as graphical abstracts that are coming out in some disciplines that are becoming very popular. And so we as instructors of EAP need to respond to those emerging changes within particular disciplines, but also help not only students, but we have the ability, I think, to help established scholars as well better understand what kind of restraints are no longer, you know, we're not in a paper-based system anymore. And so there are now videos, or the capability of inserting videos and the capability of inserting multimedia into our papers, into our publications and our dissemination of research. So as even though we think that we may have it figured out sometimes as more established disciplinary scholars, there's always a lot of room for change, and there's always a lot of new innovations on the horizon that we have to be responding to.
Yeah, I'm glad you say that, Sarah, and I'm also glad you pick up that question again that I was asking there about the limits. Because, I mean, without praising EAP too much, I mean, coming from, you know, a linguistics and literature background, we study these things. This is the content of what we do. I mean, just what you're saying there, Sarah, about the fact that, you know, the abstract is evolving. It's changing and suiting different purposes and different media. I mean, for a linguist, that's more or less like, duh. You know, I mean, we study the history of language. We see how forms and genres adapt and change. We expect that. So I suppose this point I'm driving at with you as you know, experts in this field also is, why is it that very often EAP specialists themselves, and it certainly, just as you were saying, Elena, you know, institutes see a limit on what they can contribute to? I mean, I guess I'm pleading for the fact that in EAP or as linguists, our specialty is communication. So there shouldn't be a divide into how far we can enter into any field or discipline, because we're dealing with the communication side of it.
I entirely agree. And I will say that disciplinary specialists, you know, professors, faculty in the different disciplines, at least in our experience, always welcome opportunities to work with us and learn from us. So the example I gave is just one example. But I will go back to the research we've done to develop this framework of moves and steps that I said, like I said before, is cross-disciplinary. We did not just do it, us linguists, okay? When developing this framework, we collaborated with disciplinary faculty, with faculty in those 30 disciplines that we were investigating. We collected the corpus with them. We developed these move and step notions and descriptors and definitions and examples, and we worked with them back and forth to make sure that, number one, they understand what we mean, right? And so that we put it into words that are not, don't make sense only to linguists, but to also make sure that it's something that really happens in their discipline and get to their implicit knowledge in a more explicit way. So we refine the frameworks with input and feedback from those consultants in the disciplines, and I mean faculty consultants in the disciplines. And so that's why when somebody, you know, some faculty that didn't work with us before but is looking at the book now and looking at these terms and the descriptions we have, they make sense. And they're happy to see that being explicitly articulated because they don't know how to say it, put it into words for their students. It resonates with them. It's not something that we invented. We worked collaboratively with scholars in different disciplines to make sure that we do represent the expectations of the audiences in their discipline. So that's my two cents to answer your question.
Yeah, your two cents, which just backs up the idea. I mean, this is the work of the linguist, right? I mean, also getting that disciplinary insider knowledge is just, you know, that's like our research. And I suppose that was just the you know, for listeners and anyone else who cares to listen to the podcast, that, you know, this is a statement that's worth making clear to not everyone has bought in. Very many universities do have faculties that are open, just as you're describing, Elena. There's just as many, though, that don't see it that way. And that's just something I wanted to also get my 2 cents in on. I do want to 2 cents, 10 cents, 50 cents spend on some of your graphics in the book, which I found extremely helpful. And I think these are also some of the huge benefits for, early career researchers who are looking for an idea as to, yeah, so what am I doing where? I mean, for instance, you make graphic with concentric circles, the intro, the discussion in a beautiful way. One of the ones that I found really interesting was, and I would be happy to hear your comments on, is in the results. If I can, I'll test my ability to describe pictures. We're here in a audio media. So quite simply, the results are shown as two pyramids with the bases meeting in the middle. So we've got a point at the top and a point at the bottom. And then there are four positions, four moments or goals, four moves, as we would call them, that occur going down from the top to the points, to the bases meeting the fat bit, and then down to the very point again, leaving the results. And those are approaching the niche, occupying the niche, constructing the niche, and expanding the niche. I had seen similar sorts of approaches to, say, the intro or the discussion, but I've never seen a graphic of this sort describing the results. And I would be very happy to hear your, let's say, own viewpoints on this visual for what's happening in the results.
I'll try to jump in here. I think when we got to this section of the writing, we had used a lot of other different graphics. And so we were working with a graduate student who I believe was a specialist in graphic design. And so we had a lot of help with that, but just trying to get some other visual way to convey the information. And I think just starting with this idea of specificity versus generality is kind of a metaphor that runs throughout the book and in all the graphics. And so that was the idea that I had when we were brainstorming these graphics. And also this idea of the niche has been introduced, way back at the beginning and carries through. And so by the time they get to this point, they should be very familiar with this idea of what is the niche and how do you approach it and kind of ferret out what needs to be said about it. So that's kind of the background of that. Just thinking, I'm trying to think back to, how did we come up with this? And I don't remember any specific conversations, but just trying to think of different shapes to get at, like I said, the specificity versus generality of any one section or the other.
And to add to that, so Kimberly is absolutely right on point about specificity and generality. But also, if you think about it, and again, this would require listeners to read through this section, but approaching the niche is something that does not occur in an extensive amount of discourse in the results section. It's more of a reminder for the results story to be told. It's more about what is it? What's the evidence that occupies the niche, and how can we explain and interpret it? Right. So that's the bulk. And then with expanding the niche, in the results section, we don't really take the meaning of the results outside of the scope of the study. Right. So towards the end of the results, as a transition to the discussion, we only begin to expand the niche. So there is little there. And that expansion happens in the discussion conclusion section.
Yeah, it's very, very good graphic, and it does capture very intuitively. I was seeing exactly what you've just described there, and what's nice about it, it gives a flow, because you have a sense that you're going along some sort of a course, right? You start small, move big, and then head out small again. It has some motion to it. It's very nice graphic. The graphics overall, I want to stress for listeners, are extremely helpful in just capturing what it is that you're about. To stay with the results, two issues that get brought up in the book, which are perhaps worth also just broaching here for our listeners, and two issues that very much become questions I know in my own courses, helping graduate and postdocs in their own writing, relating to the results is about balance. And that is the balance between the results text, the body text, and captions. And then the balance generally, which is explored at length in the book, between the balance of the results and what it has to say about interpretation and the discussion and its main purpose of interpretation. I wonder if those two balances would be something that you could also offer your opinions or views on.
I'm not sure if I understood the balance question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Sometimes I do that. Well, I'll just start off with the first question. We'll just move to the other one. The one is inside of the results section itself. You have the body text where you're exploring the results in all its detail, and then comes a set of parentheses, figure one. See figure one or whatever, right? Or as you see in figure one, any sort of reference. And then you go over to figure one and then you get a caption, which depending on fields can be more or less expansive. I've noticed in the biological sciences that they'll use that space to say quite a lot. I've noticed in the computer sciences, they keep it to a sentence, basically. But this is a perennial question that I hear coming up amongst novice writers is, okay, so why am I creating these two texts that the caption and the text and the results itself, which potentially very much could overlap? What are the purposes that I'm serving with each of them?
I think that if I could just say a few words, I think one of the things that we want readers to do, as you know, as well as these the students that we're using this text with. We'd like them to see how that visual supports the text, the actual text, and the particular section. So within the results section, but also could be potentially seen as a standalone item. And so it should be, and we encourage our students to see those visuals, the figures and the graphs, and even the tables as, you know, elements unto themselves. As we all know, sometimes we open up a research article and we scroll through. Some of the things that catch our attention are those visuals. And so if someone does simply look at, you know, the graphic, what are they able to glean? What kind of information are they able to glean from that graphic? And can it be standalone if separated from the text? And so it really is discipline specific as to how much of a description, you know, is provided in the caption. Of course, we don't want, with such a minimal word count and restrictions on these word limits, we don't want students to be redundant, but also we need to have them understand how those visuals and the captions should be supporting the text and how they're explaining their results and what they mean.
And sometimes, again, this is something that depends on the discipline as well. Sometimes the caption would give a summary of multiple details provided in the visual, and in the actual narrative in the section, in some paragraph that makes this alternative presentation of the results or relates students, readers to the visual, what writers may want to do is just highlight something that's most essential. So in the text, it would be the highlight that's worth bringing up, reporting, and further discussing, while in the caption, it may be more of a story with some detailed explanation of the actual graphic. But again, like I said, it depends on the discipline.
Yeah, that's something I very much noticed in the biological sciences, that just what you've said there, you know, the text follows the story, the caption shows you all the details, you know, for interest and further evidence sake. The other balance I was talking about, which I'd be, without any pun intended, happy to hear you weigh in on, is between the results and the discussion itself. Because the results is doing some work that the discussion is meant to do. I suppose that's great. More the question that people are putting to themselves than rather, am I saying too much about the results in the discussion? So in other words, the interpretation, the beginning of the interpretation, as you describe it, expanding the niche, how does that fit in with what you're going to then go on to do in the discussion? Where do readers stop? How can they find whether or not they've ended up with a nice balance in their sections?
Thank you for reformulating the question about balance. Makes perfect sense. This is really one of the challenges, a very substantial challenge that students and novice writers have. How do I make my results different from my discussion? What should I say in the discussion that I haven't already said in the results? So one thing that we try to convey in the book and also when we teach is to think of the results in the results section as these pieces that contribute to findings, to something that can be formulated more generally as a finding. And if they discuss, because we do have similar strategies in the results and in the discussion, and the way we explain it to students is that in the results, you try to explain the meaning of the specific results, specific pieces within your results, and interpret them within the scope of the study. So what do they mean within the scope of the study? Okay. In the discussion section, then you focus on the more general findings and take that discussion, interpretation, explanation, hypothesizing outside of the scope of the study into the field and start comparing with literature and start maybe making some theoretical interpretations. So that's a simple way of trying to explain where this balance may come in, right? So in the results, you focus on, you discuss them within the scope of the study. How do they apply to, I don't know, the participants, the setting, why certain things you think may have happened this way, considering how the study was conducted, where and with whom. And then in the discussion, you step outside the study territory and you start looking into the general broad knowledge that your discipline has generated and how yours fits in there.
Would it be safe to say then that as the authors of a study, when you're in the results, you're able to write those more or less on your own. But when you're in the discussion, you've got to include the rest of your scholarly community.
That would be a fair judgment, although in the results, sometimes you may also bring some reference to evidence from the discipline as well.
Right. Yeah.
There may be some comparison contrasts that need to occur as those, you know, results are being directly reported as well in the results, if it's a clean results versus a mix of results and discussion.
And some disciplines have very dry results sections. When we, in our research, when we created the so-called DNA images of the structure of the results section, we had a very nice visual way of understanding what actually happens in those results sections. So a lot of disciplines are were really just color-coded in one color, which is reporting specific results. There was no introduction or transition from the methods, and there was no discussion. Absolutely, it was just one dry, very statistically focused kind of discussion. And it, so again, this is depending on the discipline. I'll stop.
Well, that's great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you. That is Sarah Huffman, Elena Kotas, and Kimberly Becker. And their book, Preparing to Publish, is out open access with Iowa State University Digital Press. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Sarah, Elena, and Kimberly. Goodbye.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Daniel.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.